Chapter 15. The weekend passes in relative quiet. Allison has an archery tournament to go to. Styles takes the opportunity to pull Chris aside and ask what their policy is on human sorcerers. Chris says it's the same as werewolves. If that person is destroying lives, then they should be put down. Styles mentions that some people can put black magic aside, give up the power. Chris looks rather skeptical of this claim, and says if so, he's never met anyone who's done it. Styles doesn't say anything about Deaton, because that's not Chris's business. So, let's say, theoretically, that this sorcerer in town has taken on an apprentice, he says. A person my own age. I know that you guys tend to err on the side of not killing teenagers, which, thank you for that, by the way. This person is casting magical spells that are escalating. Quickly. What's your intervention?
Kill the master sorcerer, Chris says immediately. Then the apprentice can be saved.
Okay. But the master sorcerer is using the apprentice as an intermediary. I can't get to the master sorcerer. And it's the apprentice who's causing all the trouble.
Styles hesitates, then adds,
you know, in this hypothetical situation.
The look on Chris's face clearly conveys how unimpressed he is with Styles' attempts at obfuscation.
You can't kill the apprentice, he says, if that's what you're thinking.
I'd get in trouble for that, huh? Styles says.
It would be frowned upon, Chris says dryly. Particularly since you don't even know whether he became the sorcerer's apprentice voluntarily. They have been known to conscript if they find someone with talent who isn't interested. Black magic can be so powerfully addicting that once they force someone to participate in it, they can't always stop.
Styles rubs his hands over his face and tries to stop picturing Mickey Mouse and dancing brooms.
Why is this my life? He mutters. I didn't know that, about the conscription, he adds, and Chris just shrugs as if to say that he doesn't know which way it went and doesn't think it matters.
So, the apprentice is off limits. Okay, good to know. At least until he, you know, kills somebody. Because if he does, this shit is done, and I don't particularly care what it would mean for our truce.
Chris sighs. There are means of intervention.
Binding or stripping the power, Styles says. Yeah, I know. But I've heard it's pretty difficult to do that to someone who's unwilling. What are we going to do? Chain him up in your basement?
It's a good thing that looks can't kill, given the one Chris is leveling at him. Then he says, if necessary.
Okay, new twist. He's a minor and the son of the district attorney.
Chris blinks at him, then says reluctantly, that does complicate matters. But I don't imagine it really makes murder a more attractive option either.
True, Styles admits.
There are people who deal with this sort of thing.
Chris says people like it's a proper noun.
Organizations would be a better word. They come in and clean up when it's a human causing trouble. Someone hunters can't, or at least most won't, touch.
But that can't be contained by conventional, mundane means.
But it's not the sort of thing our apprentice would come back from, Styles surmises. And Chris gives him a sidelong glance, but then nods.
Styles sighs and decides he'll hold that as a last resort.
Yeah, I'd prefer to avoid it if possible.
Then my answer doesn't change. Go after the master. That's your problem.
Styles sighs and thanks him and says he'll get right on that as soon as he can find the motherfucker. Then he goes back to watching Allison dominate the field of archery. Things remain quiet for most of the week. Styles snatches naps here and there, still not really able to sleep very well. He gets a metric ton of microfilm records in his email and starts sifting through them one day at a time, looking for unusual things that might have happened while Deaton and Stone were living with the Saunders together, flexing their magical muscles.
He gets an email from Danny every day during sixth period, detailing the lesson the night before. Unfortunately, Danny isn't able to get a lot of useful information, since it basically comes down to Jackson learning to focus his energy and direct it using models and dolls. Occasionally, they have lessons about different herbs and mixtures, but Danny says those bore the shit out of Jackson, and they usually move on to something else after 10 minutes. The useful things he learns is that Jackson is not taking specific direction from Stone. The spells he's using, what he decides to do, is all his own idea. This news that what he did to Lydia was indeed a spell of his own creation only makes Stiles more homicidal. But he keeps it to himself, not telling anyone else, not even Derek. He had expected it anyway. The way he's directing his spells, at Scott and Lydia, at the people he's directly angry at, just screams Jackson. Stone is giving him free rein. He doesn't care what Jackson's doing as long as it makes Stiles' life miserable. Danny says he'll start pitching some ideas at Jackson, pranks that might actually be funny, or at least not harmful, particularly if he can warn Stiles that they're coming. Stiles appreciates the effort, but he isn't surprised when Danny glumly admits that he's not getting anywhere. In fact, all he seems to be doing is pissing Jackson off with his suggestions of things like, let's tie all their shoelaces together, and let's replace all their lunches with plastic food. So Stiles tells him to stop before Jackson gets any more angry at him. On the upside, when Jackson converts, let's replace their lunches with plastic food, into let's replace their lunches with toxic sludge, at least Danny is able to warn them about it. Stiles quietly disposes of all their lunch bags in the trash, and then they all spend the day acting sick. Things are equally quiet on the Harris front, because until he actually files his suit, they won't know how to respond. He takes so long about it that Stiles starts to hope that he won't actually do it. But then, on Friday, there it is. It's a laundry list of complaints about how he has been handled by the Stilinski family in general. Among other things, he's saying that Stiles' service dog can't be legal because it's obviously a wolf hybrid, which are illegal to own in the state of California without a wildlife permit. The lawsuit hits the papers on Sunday, which is, of course, the edition that everybody in town gets, since a lot of them don't bother with the daily paper anymore. It's also the headline story on the Beacon Hills Tribune website. Stiles spends some quality time screaming into his pillow and beating a tree with his baseball bat before cornering his father in the kitchen on Sunday afternoon and saying, "Okay, what do we do about this?" Sheriff Stilinski sighs. "Stiles," he says patiently, "we do not do anything. Mr. Klohlenberg has a copy of the suit. He's going to file our response next week. It won't go before a judge until a few days later." Stiles paces around the kitchen. "What about the wolf hybrid thing?" he asks. "I can write something up for you about why you can't prove that. There's stuff on genotyping, and really, all dogs are wolf hybrids if you go back far enough." His father takes him by the shoulders. "Stiles," he repeats, not unkindly. "We are handling this. You have enough on your plate right now. I'm sure Mr. Klohlenberg, being a lawyer who works a lot of supernatural cases, has adequate knowledge about wolf hybrids and a research department. This guy is a big-time lawyer who has something like 8 paralegals on staff. We don't need you to write a report on genotyping." It takes Stiles a minute to unclench his jaw long enough to respond. "Okay, but look at this fucking article. They make you look like the Antichrist." "Yeah, I'm gonna have a word with them about that," Stilinski says. "This whole, the sheriff was not available for comment thing is bullshit. I have some friends over there. The fact that the lawsuit is baseless will be well publicized. Trust me." "People won't read the follow-up. It's the initial headline that's going to stick in their minds. Stiles," his father says, actually shaking him a little. "You have to let this go. I can handle this. I did get this job in the first place, you know.
I do know how to be a politician. Everything's going to be fine. Mr. Klolenberg is a very good lawyer. Now, I'm not going to file a countersuit because I want to appear as the bigger man here and take the high road. But trust me, kid, everyone in Beacon Hills is going to know that Harris is just persecuting us because he was involved in the Hale House fire and he's pissed that I found out. He'll be a pariah before the end of this. Let me handle this. You go be a teenager for once. Stilinski lets him go, and then takes his keys and leaves because he has work to do. Stiles just stares after him, frustration boiling up in his throat until it's practically rage. He doesn't even know how to express all the ways he wants to freak out. He wants to take his baseball bat and introduce it to Harris's face. He wants to write angry letters to the editor. He wants to paper the entire town in flyers that talk about what a douche Harris is. But he can't do anything. All he can do is stand there in his kitchen and want to scream. Because life isn't fair. Stiles learned that when he was 7, sitting in his child-sized black suit at his mother's funeral, wondering when his mom was coming back from heaven and why everyone was crying. He learned it when he was 10, when Scott was coming over 3 nights a week because his parents were fighting again, and he thought it was his fault. He learned it when he was 13, when hormones kicked in, but the beautiful strawberry blonde that he had loved since forever ignored him in favor of the jerk who was always trying to introduce his face to the bottom of a toilet bowl. And he had learned it at 16, when Peter had arrived and turned his world upside down. He can handle life not being fair, but what he can't handle is not being able to do anything about it. And it seems so stupid that in the entire world of magic and monsters, it's one mundane asshole with a stupid grudge that's trying to bring everything down around his ears. He's glad that the rest of the pack isn't there. Sunday is typically family day, especially when things have been rough and their parents all want them to spend some time at home. Lydia and Allison are spending the morning at Lydia's house and then going over to Allison's for dinner and to spend the night. Isaac is hanging out with Scott at his place, and Erica is helping Boyd with chores around the house until mid-afternoon, at which point they're going to go back to Erica's for the rest of the day. So it's only Stiles and Derek at the Stilinski house, and Derek was giving them plenty of room during their father-son discussion. He's sketching in the living room, pretending he hasn't heard a word. Abruptly, Stiles grabs the keys to the Jeep and says, "I'm going to go to the store. I need to buy some cheap steaks for dinner." Cheap steaks are good. Cheap steaks require maximum abuse with a meat tenderizer before they'll be edible, and he really, really feels like beating the crap out of something right now. Derek doesn't question, but asks, "Should I shift?" "Yeah," Stiles says. He wants everyone in fucking town to see him with his service dog. He wants everyone to know about it. So Derek shifts and Stiles gets the blue vest on him, and they go down to the Jeep. Stiles tries to be quick at the grocery store. He feels sharp and edgy. Every little noise has him flinching. Hypervigilance, he tells himself, knowing from all his reading. He focuses on his breathing and the feeling of Derek's leash wrapped around his wrist. Whenever he jumps, Derek presses into his leg, which calms him down a little. No one will sneak up on him while Derek is there. "Fuck my life," he mutters to himself. The lie they've told to keep Derek with him is rapidly becoming the truth. Once they get home, he lays the steaks out on cutting boards and gets out the meat tenderizer. "You should go out back or upstairs," he says. Derek growls at him. In response, Stiles slams the tool down on the steak. The loud thump, almost a bang, makes Derek flinch. "Yeah, I'm going to do that approximately 500 times, Stiles says. "Save your ears. Go water a tree." Derek slumps, noses at Stiles' hand, and then pads up the stairs. Stiles has a suspicion that he's going to go into the bedroom and bury his head under a pillow, which is fine with him. He's angry at the world, even angry at Derek, even though there's absolutely no reason to be. He's angry at himself for needing Derek, for putting his father through all this trouble because of his own shortcomings. So he takes it out on the steaks. Cheap London broil, on sale for $2.99 a pound, almost an inch and a half thick and guaranteed to be tougher than shoe leather once cooked. He cuts it into small strips and gets to work. As he had expected, the work is therapeutic. Seeing each steak thin out into a nice 3/4 of an inch as he beats the crap out of it is productive and satisfying. He tosses each one into a pan as he's done, and then considers sautéing some mushrooms and onions to go with it. They can eat in style. He should have had Derek buy some wine. Or whiskey. He really feels like he could go for some whiskey right now. Once all the steak is done, he just stands there and leans against the counter for a minute. The rage has exhausted him, leaving him spent and empty. He closes his eyes for a minute. They snap open when he hears a noise a second later. It's the creak of a floorboard underneath a shoe. He looks up to find Peter Hale standing in his kitchen. The former Alpha looks about as bad as the last time Stiles saw him. He still has the scars that Gerard had left on him. His veins are laced dark blue with wolfsbane. His hair lies limp around his face. And when he smiles, several of his teeth are missing. "Stiles," he says, that too gentle voice that has haunted Stiles' nightmares. "Have you missed me?" Stiles sucks in a breath to scream, but all that comes out is a strangled little whimper. His mind is frozen, shutting down. He thinks with strange lucidity, "So this is what going crazy feels like." His back is pressed against the counter, and there's nowhere for him to go. His hand tightens around the meat tenderizer he's still holding, and he holds it out, brandishing it like a weapon with hands that are violently trembling. Peter smoothly pushes it away, a motion that seems to require no effort at all. He steps a little closer, bringing them within inches of each other. "You stole my pack, Stiles," he murmurs. "Did you think I was going to let you get away with that?" None of it's real. It can't be real. But Stiles can smell him, can smell the wolfsbane and the alpha and the faint stench of rot, of decay. It smells like the inside of the trunk of his car. Stiles realizes distantly that he stopped breathing, that he's starting to feel faint, dizzy. It's not real, so there's no cause for panic, he reasons. And so he just stands there, while Peter's teeth sink into his shoulder and he feels the alpha inside him start to drain away. "Stiles, what the hell?" Derek's voice is sudden, sharp, and Stiles jerks to attention. He looks around, gasping. He's alone in the kitchen, and Derek is standing in the doorway. Peter is nowhere to be seen. Stiles' hand automatically goes to his shoulder to find it whole and uninjured. He lets out a little whimper, and his knees buckle. "Jesus, Stiles," Derek says, grabbing him before he can fall. "What happened?"
Get me to Deaton," Stiles chokes out. I can't."
"Okay." Derek doesn't question. He just gets an arm around Stiles' waist and scoops him up like a child. Stiles doesn't protest, although typically he finds it embarrassing to be carried around. Derek grabs the keys to the Jeep on the way out the door, not even stopping to put shoes on either of them. He dumps Stiles in the passenger seat and then stops to put his seatbelt on him. Then he gets behind the wheel and peels out of the driveway. Stiles just sits there with his face buried in his arms, his entire body shaking, wondering what in God's name Jackson has done to him and how he's done it. He's pretty sure that one more vision like that will push him around the bend permanently. Deaton is waiting when they get there, so Derek must have called ahead.
although Stiles certainly hadn't noticed him doing so.
What happened? Deaton asks, as they get Stiles inside.
I have no idea, Derek says. He was in the kitchen cooking, and suddenly I could feel him panicking. But when I got downstairs, everything looked normal.
I saw... Stiles chokes out. I saw Peter. He
tries to talk, but the words are sticking in his throat.
He wanted to take the pack from me.
Jesus, Derek mutters. I'm going to take him downstairs, Deaton says. Then remembers Stiles' reaction to the cellar and shakes his head.
Never mind. But could you give us a little privacy, Derek? I'll need to be able to concentrate.
Derek hesitates, but then nods and goes back out to the lobby. Deaton makes Stiles sit down on the floor right where he is and helps him take deep breaths for several long minutes. Stiles stays curled up in a ball until the shaking finally starts to ease. Once he's back in control of himself, he looks up at Deaton and says,
Did you?
Stiles, Deaton says quietly, there's no magic on you. Stiles blinks at him stupidly.
What?
No one has done any magic on you, Deaton says. I think you just had a hallucination, probably brought on by the stress of the last few weeks.
But I...
Stiles can only stare at him, then shakes his head. No!
There's something wrong with me, and I need you to fix it!
Stiles, Deaton says, careful to keep his tone gentle and reassuring. You've been under enormous amounts of pressure, and flashbacks or hallucinations are not uncommon with post-traumatic stress disorder, or sleep deprivation, which I'm sure you're also suffering from. What happened today was not the result of sorcery.
Fuck,
Stiles says, pressing his hands against his face. He can't think of anything else to say, so he repeats it, louder, with more emphasis.
Fuck!
I sent Derek out because I wasn't sure if you would want him to know, Deaton says. But you probably want to tell him, so he'll be prepared if it happens again.
Again? Stiles blurts out.
He tries not to freak out.
Why is this happening? I haven't had real flashbacks in over 7 months now. Not since my dad got out of the hospital, really. And it's not like bad things haven't happened to me in the meantime. What with the fairies and asshole werewolf packs and crazy alpha pack shit.
I think what's triggering you is this feeling of helplessness, Deaton says. When the alpha pack was in town, when other packs wanted to take your territory, there were things you could do, ways you could fight back. You had a plan, and you were able to fight for what was yours. In this situation, you've spent a lot of time unable to do anything. Your hands are tied in almost every arena right now, both with the warlock and with what's happening to your father. Did something happen today?
Stiles deflates.
Yeah, Dad basically told me to step off and let him handle it, because I would only make things worse. I mean, he didn't mean it in a bad way, and he's not wrong, but...
Deaton gives a little nod.
But it's hard to sit by and watch things happen, unable to influence events around you.
Yeah, and this whole thing with Jackson and...
Stiles tries to swallow past the lump in his throat. I'd better get home, he says abruptly. I left the steak on the counter.
Okay,
Deaton says. He doesn't question Stiles' abrupt wish to depart. He just helps him back to his feet and steers him back out to the lobby. Derek is pacing back and forth, agitated. He looks up as they come out, and Deaton just gives him his normal reassuring smile and says, He'll be okay. Derek obviously isn't sure he believes that. When Stiles is still trembling, and he smells like fear and pain and bitter frustration, with a side order of shame and self-loathing. But he accepts it, because he isn't about to have the conversation in front of Deaton. He helps Stiles out to the car and puts him in the passenger seat.
Derek doesn't say anything on the way home, because he has a feeling that the conversation is going to involve physical comfort as much as words. And he doesn't want to start it in a place where he can't really touch Styles. His attention is diverted enough as it is, between watching the road and keeping an eye on his alpha. Once he pulls into the driveway and turns off the Jeep, he sits for a moment and waits to see if Styles will make any move on his own to get out. He does, but his legs are shaking so badly that he almost immediately sinks back into the seat to avoid falling. Derek gets out and circles the Jeep, opening the passenger door and helping Styles out of the vehicle and into the house. I have to... Styles goes into the kitchen and stares at the half-prepared food. He feels queasy. He can feel the counter pressed into his back and Peter's breath against his neck. He berates himself for being ridiculous. Being afraid of his own kitchen is not on the list of things that are going to happen today. Styles' fear hits Derek from multiple directions. He can hear the spike in Styles' heart rate and smell it, but it's also washing down the bond between them, along with some form of anger. He thinks about telling Styles to go wait in the living room while he puts the food away, but then decides against it. Not if they can help it. Derek doesn't know what happened, but he does know that the kitchen belongs to Styles. It's his safe place, where he goes when other things upset him, so this is something that needs to be fixed. He comes up to Styles and wraps his arms around him in a hug, making sure to approach from the side so Styles can see him coming. They stand there, in the doorway of the kitchen together. "What happened?" he asks. "What did they do to you?" "Peter was here," Styles says, staring into the kitchen. "He was right there. I could see him. I could smell him. I could feel his teeth." He takes a hitching little breath. "It was so fucking real." Derek sniffs the air in a blatantly canine gesture that he usually tries to avoid displaying. "I don't smell him, or anything out of place." His tone is merely informative. He's imparting information rather than suggesting that it hadn't happened. "He bit you?" "Yes. No!" Styles pulls away, frustrated, and pushes both hands through his hair. "Nothing happened! Nothing happened! Deaton..." He chokes on the word. "Deaton said no magic had been done on me." "Something happened," Derek says firmly. "Just because no magic had been done on you doesn't mean something wasn't done to you or directed at you." Styles stares at Derek and kind of wants to throw himself off a bridge. "Derek, I just had a flashback. That's what happened. It's..." He tries to take a breath to steady himself. "It wasn't magic. It was just my own fucked up psyche playing tricks on me." Derek closes his eyes for a second and breathes out slowly. Magic they can fight. This is so much harder. "I'm sorry," he says, and hesitantly opens his arms to Styles. I'm sorry. I haven't really slept in days," Styles says. He ignores Derek's arms in favor of just sitting down right where he is, hitting the floor with a thud. "Deaton says that sleep deprivation can cause hallucinations, which I knew, but I'm trying to sleep. I just can't. There's too much going on, and I'm sitting here with my hands tied, and I can't do anything about any of it." After a moment, Derek folds himself down onto the floor, facing Styles. He tries to think of comforting things to say, about how this mess with Harris and his father isn't his job to handle. But he knows that Styles has heard it before. In fact, that's half the problem. There's nothing that can be said about Stone, because they just need to put a stop to him somehow, and they haven't figured how to do that yet. So he tries something different. "Right after Kate..." He stops, swallows, and tries again. "When my family died,
I was terrified that I would lose Laura, too. He doesn't want to think about how, in the end, that fear was entirely valid. It was paralyzing. I knew that the bond between Alpha and Beta would tell me she was safe, but I just couldn't trust anything but my own eyes. I had to be able to see her. For months, I was like that. Her first job was waiting tables at a little mom-and-pop restaurant, because they didn't mind having some weird teenager sitting at a table in a corner, staring at one of their waitresses all day. Looking back, he can see how kind that couple had been to him and Laura. I couldn't sleep either, because what if something happened to her while I was asleep? He rubs a hand over his face, suddenly, painfully missing his sister. He pushes it back, because he has Styles to worry about now, and that's more important. So she made me exercise. We both did, but mostly me. I just ran or worked out until I was so fucking exhausted that nothing was going to stop me from sleeping. Styles is quiet for a long minute. He knows how difficult it still is for Derek to talk about his family, especially Laura. He knows how Derek is even now thinking that maybe, if he had kept his eyes on her, she wouldn't have been killed. He hugs his knees to his chest and says, "Did it get better?" "Yeah." Derek nods. He leans forward with his elbows on his knees. "It was slow and hard, but it did." Styles manages a wan smile and says, "Well, I hope you don't mind being an actual service wolf for a little while."
"I don't, aside from the appalling hours," Derek says, his tone almost teasing. "Do you mind me being your service dog?"
"Mind?" Styles asks, and says flatly, "I hate it. I fucking hate that I need this. That I'm dragging you to fucking high school and starting flame wars between Harris and my father because I can't get my shit together."
Derek snorts a little. "I meant, would you rather have an actual dog? I figured it was a given you didn't want any of this to happen. And you didn't start this with Harris."
Derek's shoulders tense, his voice growing tight. "I don't know what his problem is. He fucking helped murder my entire family and all the people that could have put him in jail for it cut him a break because he didn't actually plan for Kate to use the information the way she did. And what does he do? He attacks those people and the innocents attached to them? Maybe I should press charges and have his ass sent to jail for 11 counts of murder. Maybe he'd shut the fuck up then."
Somewhat wearily, Styles rubs his hands over his face and says, "It would only be accessory to murder, and he likely wouldn't get any jail time, if he got convicted at all, which would be hard since Kate's dead now. So, you know, there's that."
"He still confessed," Derek retorts, "and he would still lose his job. It would be made painfully public. My point is that I have no clue what his issue is, but he's using you to go after your dad, and that's not your fault. You didn't start it. He did."
"Yeah," Styles slumps. "I've got to get this steak cooking. You'll hang out with me while I make dinner, right?"
"Sure."
Derek stands and offers both hands to help Styles up. "After dinner, we can go for a run. And anytime you're worried about something being real, just ask me. I'll let you know."
Styles nods a little and accepts Derek's help getting to his feet. He hesitates, then says, "Don't tell the others, okay?"
Derek keeps his hands curled around Styles while he thinks about his answer. He knows how much Styles hates being out of control, and how much it makes him feel like he's failing the pack.
"Okay, but you should think about it, if sleeping more doesn't help. And I think you should tell your dad."
"My dad is the last person I want to tell," Styles says, turning away and rooting around in the fridge for the onions and mushrooms.
"Why?"
Derek boosts himself to sit in his normal spot on the counter.
"Because he'll get upset and blame himself, and it'll distract him from what he should be focusing on right now."
Stiles starts vigorously slicing onions. If I can't help him with this whole catastrophe, I can at least keep from being a pain in his ass.
Why would he blame himself? Derek asks, eyebrows raising.
Because he's a parent. Parents blame themselves when bad things happen to their children.
I think he'd be more upset that you felt like you had to hide it from him. Besides, this is sort of the point, you know. Harris thinks this is some sort of game, but it isn't. It's someone's life. It's your life. He just keeps getting away with things, and he shouldn't. It could have been some other kid at school with a service dog. Someone without the sheriff at his back.
Hey now, my dad treats everyone fairly, remember? Stiles says, and smiles for the first time since they got home. That's the whole point. My dad would support some other poor bastard just as much as he supports me, if Harris took after him the same way.
Derek cracks a smile as well. He wouldn't, but most people wouldn't think to go to him with something like that. Stiles elbows Derek in the thigh.
What's with you and your logic today? He asks.
Anyway,
the other reason my dad will blame himself is because we were arguing right before it happened.
Oh. Derek nods a little, understanding now. I'm still not changing my opinion about telling him. What were you arguing about?
Basically, I'm over here going nuts with the fact that I can't do anything about Harris, and Dad's like, leave it to me. I know how to be a politician. I did get this job in the first place. The lawyers are involved. It's out of your hands now. And my frustration level is like, code red, danger Will Robinson. And Eaton says he thinks that pervasive feeling of helplessness probably has a lot to do with my psychotic break.
Stiles punctuates this sentence by chopping an onion in half.
Derek looks at the poor, hapless onion and thinks about adding some sparring to their exercise schedule.
It's too bad that the testimony of a vet won't do us any good in court. He braces the heels of his hands on the edge of the counter to either side of his thighs. I still think you should tell your dad. If nothing else, what if this happens again and he's the only person around? Knowing ahead of time will make him worry less, because he has some idea of what's happening, and that'll make it easier for him to help you.
In what universe are you talking about letting me out of your sight?
Stiles grumps.
Okay, compromise. We're going to write this little incident off as mainly caused by sleep deprivation and the fact that I didn't see it coming. If it happens a second time, then we'll tell my dad. Fair?
Fair. Derek agrees, and you don't carry any weapons until we're sure it won't happen again.
Stiles' eyes narrow. I won't carry any distance weapons until we're reasonably sure it won't happen again.
After a moment, Derek concedes with a nod. It's mostly the sheriff that he's worried about. But if Stiles has even one more flashback, they'll be telling the man anyway. Besides that, the man is smart enough to give a combative Stiles room. At his nod, Stiles leans against the counter a little more heavily, propping his head up on one hand.
Maybe I should try Ambien again, he says. I hate how fucking groggy it made me feel, but I've gotta fucking sleep.
Let's try the exercise first, Derek says. We'll go for a run after dinner. If it doesn't help, you can try the Ambien tomorrow.
Yeah, I'd have to get a refill anyway. I think my last bottle expired.
Stiles sighs.
Thanks for being the rational one today.
Derek lets out a quiet snort. I'm sure you'll return the favor soon enough. But you're welcome.
It's an email from Danny on Tuesday afternoon that finally gives Stiles some information that he feels might actually shed some light on what happened between Deaton and Stone. Jackson has started pestering Stone about those spells he talked about to gain more power. This doesn't surprise Stiles at all. There's no way that Jackson would want to spend his whole life as a 6 on a scale of 1 to 10. Knowing what he knows now, what Danny had told him about Jackson's driving need to be the best at everything, it stands to reason that he'll just keep trying to gain more power.
So they sat down and had a detailed discussion about it, and Danny, wonderful, helpful, amazing Danny, was able to surreptitiously pull out his phone and record it. "There are two types of spells you can do to gain power," Stone says, "and they'll both cost you something. The basic difference is outside power versus inside power. Outside power is if you make a contract with a demon. Don't think of demons as something religious. They're more creatures of dark, negative energy than anything else."
"How much of religion is accurate?" Denny asks curiously. Stone waves this question off with,
"Depends on the religion, but not much. Anyway, dealing with demons is inadvisable. As you might imagine, they're tricky creatures. Their real goal is to steal your power from you. So it's a constant tug of war. A strong enough sorcerer can handle that, but it's really only something that a very confident warlock could do. Demons will flatter and manipulate you, make you vulnerable, find ways to get inside your head."
"So what about inside power?" Jackson asks.
"That has to do with tapping into your own power," Stone says. "Remember how I said that most people only go about 2 or 3 points up the scale?"
"Right, but you said you went from a 3 to a 9, Jackson says in an eager tone.
"Right, and that has everything to do with the way magic works," Stone says. "Or more accurately, with the way the mind works. Everyone has untapped potential inside them, which is locked down by fear. Fear of the unknown, fear of being isolated, fear of being too powerful. There are spells you can do to access that potential, to unlock the power inside yourself. The spells are simple in theory, but require utter, whole-scale commitment. The slightest shred of doubt can cause it to backfire in dangerous ways. You must be completely without fear if it's going to work."
Surprisingly, Jackson says nothing. Styles thinks to himself that really, Jackson has been afraid his whole life. Afraid he doesn't belong, afraid that he's not good enough. A spell like that would be immensely difficult for him.
"In any case," Stone says, "you're years away from being able to do a spell like that. Trust me on that. I did my first one years before I was ready, with nearly disastrous consequences."
"You had a shred of doubt?" Danny asks. He sounds rather doubtful himself. Stone laughs and says,
"Not me, but that's a story for another time."
The recording goes on for a while before Danny decides that nothing else of interest is going to happen and turns it off. Styles is starting to put the pieces together now. He's still not sure how the death of Stone's father fits in, if it does at all. Stone and Deaton took off to do some kind of power-up spell. Something went wrong with it. Stone saved Deaton's life. The most obvious explanation is that one of them had doubts about the power they were unlocking, and Styles is pretty sure that it wasn't Stone.
"Okay," he says to the pack, after they've all listened to the recording. "Erica has mourned Danny's homosexuality because I would give him the best blowjob ever in thanks for all this if he weren't."
And Styles has gone over all of his theories.
"Now is when we're going to set up a meeting with Stone. Who's up for it?"
Everyone is. Styles takes the opportunity the next day to go have a quiet word with Jackson while Finstock is working with some of the players who need a little remedial training.
"I want to have a word with your boss," he says.
"Like I care what you want," Jackson retorts.
Derek, who has joined Styles for this little talk, lets out a sub-audible growl. It's enough to make Jackson fidget uncomfortably. Styles just gives Jackson a smile and says,
"Okay, don't go tell Stone that the boy in red wants to talk to him. Imagine what he'll think when he finds out you kept an important message from him because of your own ego."
Jackson's jaw twitches.
"You think you're so big and bad, don't you?"
"Yes," Styles says. "Yes, I do. And so does Stone. Don't you get it, Jackson? You're just a pawn in our little game."
He twitches his fingers at him and says, "So go on. Do what pawns do.
Because this is bigger than you know and badder than you can comprehend. Give Stone my message. I want to have a word with him. He'll take it from there.
Jackson's clearly furious, but Stiles turns and walks away from him before he can respond. He whistles as he goes, just to make it more insulting. It makes him feel better to get at least a little of his own back. He suspects that he'll have to wait a few days to get a response. Stone will want to make him sweat. That's okay. He feels so much better just to be doing something, to have set some sort of plan in motion. Finstock actually shows them some new moves during practice, and Stiles is still full of energy, so the boys decide to go run around the forest for a while. Boyd is at his house with Lydia, who's helping his two younger sisters out with some kind of arts and crafts project. Allison and Erica are checking in at the Argent household. Stiles suspects that Chris actually thinks Erica is pretty funny, although he would never admit it. So they drive out into the woods beyond the Hale house and burn off some energy. It's a little chilly for November, but the movement keeps them warm. They play lacrosse, practicing the new moves and patterns, and then just run around like maniacs. Playing parkour werewolves, as Stiles is fond of saying. The sun is setting by the time they start for home. Stiles is feeling fairly mellow and relaxed, cruising down the old country road. They're almost back in town when Stiles suddenly catches sight of a silver sports car in his rearview mirror. "Fuck," he says. "Is that Jackson?" The question is answered mere moments later. Jackson's car has a lot more punch to it than Stiles' Jeep. A few seconds later, Jackson's car is close behind him. "You little fucker," Stiles mutters, stepping on the gas. "Think you can tailgate me? Is that what you think?" He takes a curve at 45 miles an hour, an easy 15 miles over the speed limit. He's going nearly 60 by the end of the next straightaway. "Which one of us knows these roads by heart, jerk off?" "Be careful, Stiles," Scott urges. "Don't let your temper get the better of you. Let him tailgate if he wants to be a douche." Stiles knows that Scott is probably right, and that the urge to slam on the brakes and crumple the hood of Jackson's fancy fiberglass car with the solid metal of his old-fashioned Jeep is not one he should obey. Technically, the accident would be Jackson's fault, but both of them would suffer insurance premiums through the roof. He can just see the look on his father's face, so he takes a deep breath, reminds himself that he should spend at least some of his life being mature and taking the high road, and hits the brakes. They're coming back into town anyway. They'll be hitting traffic soon. Which is why it's all the more disconcerting when the brakes resist for a moment, and then the pedal goes flat to the floor without making the slightest dent in his speed. "Oh shit," he says, more surprised than anything else.
"Oh shit, what?"
Scott and Isaac clamor.
My brakes just failed." Stiles pumps them several times, to no avail. "I can't slow down."
"Son of a bitch," Scott says. "Derek, shift. Get your seatbelt on." Derek just snarls at him, but Stiles says, "Dude, he's right. If you get ejected from the car at 60 miles per hour, that might be more damage than even you can take." His eyes flick up to the rearview mirror. Jackson has melted back to a reasonable distance now. He was only tailgating to get Stiles to increase his speed. "You'll be safer if you're strapped in. Do it, damn it!" A few moments later, Derek is in his human form, grabbing at the seatbelt.
"Can we just wait for the speed to bleed off?"
he asks. "It's bled off some already. They're down to 50 miles per hour now. But we won't have much time unless..." They round the last bend as they come into town, and Stiles sees what he's been dreading. The red light up ahead. As the old country lane turns into a more sensible city road, there's a four-way intersection. Worse yet, he knows that his side of the light is an on-demand light. With no one there to trip it, it will stay red. Since no one is currently sitting at the light, the odds that it will turn green before he gets there and careens through the intersection are exactly zero. He can see steady traffic moving across the road where he's heading. "Oh, fuck," he says, If they go through the intersection, odds are very good he'll hit at least one other car, or possibly several, and cause a multi-car pileup. The other cars contain people that are not werewolves, and the Jeep is tough enough to deal out serious damage if it broadsides someone. Oh fuck, hold on everybody, he blurts out, and jerks the wheel to the side, steering the car right off the road. The Jeep bounces and jolts as it drives onto the grass and gravel that lines the road. He pumps the brakes instinctively, hoping that the rough terrain will help slow the car down. But the Jeep is still going an easy 40 miles per hour when they go into a ditch that he didn't even see coming in the dim light. The collision knocks all the air out of him. The car bounces, flips, and then there's another bang and a crash, and everything goes black.